Carr, who is most recently the author of Luminarium. Alex, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
As the motorcycle goes by, I wanted to first of all start off by discussing a recent essay you wrote for the Wall Street Journal in which you divided novelists into scientists and mystics. You suggested that the scientist is someone who pre-thinks the story, and the mystic is someone who kind of just goes along for the ride, flies by the seats of her pants.
Right.
That the best novelist is somewhere in between. And I'm curious, since Luminarium took 10 years for you to write, since you were dealing with multiple drafts, hundreds of pages, my question is how you could shift gears, because I know, for example, the twin brother, George, was a later addition. So it's almost like you're going from Earth being the center of the universe to the sun being the center of the universe.
Yeah.
How does this work for you, switching along these lines, just out of curiosity?
Yeah. It just seems to be my process. Even for The Savage Girl, for my last novel, it started off as a novel that took place in Austin, Texas, and it was about slackers hanging out and smoking cigarettes, and then over the drafts, everything changed, including the protagonist. She wasn't even in the first draft, and then she came into subsequent drafts. The city changed to a fictional city built on a volcano, and there's usually some core that stays the same, and then everything changes around it. And in the case of Luminarium, I really, George is in a way that I consider now that pretty much the center of the book. I mean, he's not the protagonist, but he's what the whole story revolves around. And so it was really like, I spent a long time, draft after draft, and the books really just kept sucking, and I couldn't really figure out why. It was just, it just felt like the pieces just weren't coming together, and I couldn't get really beneath the surface of my subject, so it wasn't until, and I had this idea for George earlier on, or at least for a twin brother, it was in the back of my mind, and I kept saying, oh no, that'll just complicate it even more. I've got, you know, it's such a complicated story, why add another component to it?
Yeah.
But I was amazed once I started going in that direction how it actually allowed everything else to really snap together around it. It was like a new backbone and a new heart for the book, and so it was nice for me to see how it was evolving in that direction.
I'm presuming Sam was there in these earlier drafts,
yeah.
And I'm wondering if he was possibly an overstuffed character, that the sort of big ideas that George brought to this company were there within Sam in an earlier draft, or did you have such items as the tweezers, which seemed to reflect the kind of twin theme that was going on? The narcissist idea, did it just need to be more explicit, and is this one of the reasons why George came to fruition? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I think it helped. It helped me just manifest and physicalize and emotionalize a lot of the stuff that was going on in the story. It felt for a long time like I was looking for something. I kept trying to figure out. I mean, the main problem was what sends Fred on this journey, you know. So, you know, and it's a hell of a journey that he goes on. So it really took something to set him off on it without, you know, just making him seem like a navel-gazing, you know.
Yeah.
Which that was the way he seemed in the earlier drafts to me. And so I experimented with giving Fred different illnesses. I gave him a heart condition, and then after a couple of months, I started getting chest pains and had to check myself into the hospital. And so luckily that plot element didn't pan out anyway.
You were prescient about your own health. My goodness.
So, I don't know, the chicken and the egg, you know. There,
yeah.
But
how do you determine what the right medical condition is? That's just an interesting question. I mean, clearly you don't want to feel it, but perhaps it sort of manifested in this unknown way. But I mean, how do you sort of zero in on what seems to be right in this case?
Yeah, well, for Fred, it took externalizing it, and it took giving him the brother, and you know, it was odd, you know, because it's the book is so much about selfhood, and it's so much about, you know, interiority.
Yeah.
That at first it seemed counterintuitive for me to give him the brother, but that actually helped. I think that helped manifest and externalize, you know, some of the stuff that was going on. So instead of talking to himself in his head all the time, he's talking to George, and that, you know, I think that really brings it down to earth in a way.
There are other Georges that are scattered throughout the book. Yeah. I'm wondering if George the name was there before George the body, the comatose body in the hospital, was there.
No, I don't think so. No, okay. You know, I mean, I'm trying to remember if George Bush was.
Yeah,
so, I think he was, actually. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. You're right about that. Yeah.
You told the New York Observer that you knew you wanted to write about spirituality, but that it took you a while to figure out that you didn't understand it. Are the best fiction subjects those that are unknowable? At what point do you know in the writing that you really don't know enough?
I wish I'd figure that out sooner, but it took me about 3 or 4 years of work on the novel before I decided that I needed some hands-on experience. I had done a lot of reading before that point, and I was kind of drawn to writings of mystics and contemplatives, and then I saw that it was just something that wasn't only for these people, you know, that it was something that seemed accessible for a human being, and so it was something that I wanted to go and try out. So I went to my neighborhood Zendo, I don't know what I was expecting exactly, but I had a bunch of big questions on my mind, and the guy sat me down and just taught me how to breathe,
yeah,
and how to sit, and these were things that I had thought I knew how to do. So it was strange at first, but I stuck with it. You know, I sat, I breathed, I counted to 10, and so for the last 5 years, I've been doing it pretty regularly, meditating, going on retreats, and I've found a lot of terrific things in it, and it I think it helped me. It helped me get a kind of handle on the kinds of experiences that Fred was having, and or at least some of them, and it helped me feel like the material was my own a little bit more, and it also, you know. There's a lot of elements of Zen which ended up coming into play in the book. So.
Well, this experience of learning how to breathe and learning how to count at the end of each part has this countdown, and I don't want to give it away. There actually is a different form of counting that occurs at the very end. But I'm curious how that manifested itself in that particular visual way, where the actual word of the number aligns itself up with the paragraph like that, and how something like this experience translates into words, or how words translate into experience, and how this kind of mishmashes over the course of coming up with something like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's you asked before, like, whether you know the best books are impossible to write in a way.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that interests me, you know, and that seems to I seem to be drawn to things that I don't understand, and that I feel like I need to learn about. And my way of representing it physically on the page, I mean, it's not you know, the novel is mostly pretty straightforward in terms of narrative, but occasionally, yeah, I'll play with the placement of numbers on the page just to try to get that hypnotic sensibility into it. And then there are the visual images too, the little icons on the chapters, and that was something that I I didn't really know why I was doing it first. It wasn't something that Soho Press did. It was something that I was doing earlier on with an artist, and I just kind of had the ideas for the icons but once I saw her doing them, and once she was sending them to me, they became a part of the story in a way, and they became actually gradually became a part of the plot itself, and so. And then the other design elements in the book came afterward. The calendars and the whole design of the book so you know you want a book to be you know it's just words on a page but you want it to be as immersive as possible. So
I have to say there seems to be this problem in fiction. And I have to, unfortunately, bring up the tired subject of September 11th. But I think in your book, you managed to broach the subject without it being nauseating, which I know it sounds like a sort of backhanded compliment, but I really was impressed by that. And as awkward as that way of phrasing it might be, I'm just curious from a process level how you were able to broach this loaded subject, this subject in which for a while... Well, one could not write about September 11th. In fact, here we are very close to the 10th anniversary and one still can't quite approach it. But the way you do it in this, I don't know exactly why I wasn't bothered in this instance. That's a very rare thing. How conscious of playing the 9/11 card were you in trying to compete with this rather crowded field of catastrophic... post-ironic fiction, so to speak.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and I'm glad to hear you say that. I knew in a way as it was going, I saw that 9/11 was going to be an important part of the book. But for me, what really interested me and where I saw the heat of the story was on all the reactions to it, all the 9/11 novels that have come so far are kind of a part of the story, and I set it in 2006 as being this time when it was, you know, that when 9/11 was just starting to become history.
Yeah.
And everybody had positioned themselves in one way or the other in crafting their particular 9/11 novels, 9/11 movies, or just creating their interior narratives about what it meant to them. And that was something that I felt that my characters were doing as well, and that was something that obviously I felt that the book was doing as well. But I really wanted it to be about the whole culture that absorbs and processes and tries to make meaning of the event.
Yeah. I'm curious, I mean, setting 2006 is the sort of hard line date, the hard code date, so to speak. Is this really a situation where you're exploring technology, spirituality, how we are entrapped by faith, and specifically the rapid changes that cause these developments to occur? When writing about such a subject, does it inevitably become a historical novel? Is there no way to really broach the subject in the present or in the future? It has to actually always be looked at in the past in order to really deal with it. Is that one of the considerations for 2006? Or?
I think it partly came out of writing The Savage Girl.
Yeah.
And I had intended The Savage Girl to be... It was always in my mind an alternate present, and people seemed to read it as the near future, and that I was trying to predict the future, and for me that wasn't really what I was doing. I was writing about our cultural moment, and so with this book I wanted to try to find a period of time, and write about the present as if it were history, and that picking 2006 a lot, I thought it would come out a bit sooner.
Yes.
But
sure.
it allowed me, and I'm glad it didn't, because it allowed me the time to really process it and to really focus on on an era, on a particular era.
But also locking it into a specific time allows you a considerable amount of latitude when it comes to exploring space. Was 2006 locked in from the very beginning when you were starting to explore?
No, okay. I had originally, and this was part of the problem, was that I had originally set it right after 9/11. And it was not only too soon for me to be writing about it, it was too soon. It was just too soon for the story to take place.
Yeah.
And so it, you know, once 2006 rolled around, I kind of thought this is the year, you know.
Yeah.
And then that's when I started moving everything to that year, and it really gelled. And, you know, I mean, just I came here and I walked around on the anniversary.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So walking around New York to sort of get a lot of the landmarks in this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that you name the Empire State Building, but you don't name the Brooklyn Bridge, which I found quite interesting. And there's a few other places I recognized as I'm a big walker.
Yeah.
And so I was noticing that, okay, he's mentioning this part of, you know, Union Square and not this. And so what was the criteria for that? I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't really know. I'm a big walker myself. Fred walks around a lot in the novel. I tried to you know, like there were certain things that seemed like they would be landmarks to Fred, the Zeckendorf Towers, and the Empire State Building, and I'm not sure why I didn't name the Brooklyn Bridge.
This leads me to wonder about Zeckendorf, which is also related to the Fibonacci situation, where that's the sum of the numbers and all that. But you also have, for example, the name Brownian, the surname which could either be Eva Braun or could be Brownian motion. There, of course, is Manfred in this, which I'm thinking, oh, well, it's Fred's godfather, God, man. There's a very almost over-deliberate, but in a way that is extraordinarily precise, concern for names on your part. And I'm wondering the extent of thinking and double meaning and twin meanings that you placed for some of these names. I was wondering if you could talk about this.
Yeah, it's what's important to me names are a tricky thing, I think, in a novel. Every student of writing, every undergraduate, you know, seems to expect that there's going to be a secret meaning in a name.
Yeah,
and I remember with the Savage Girl, I was talking to a class, and the students were looking into the names, and they seemed to find a lot of significance in them, and I did too. But they asked me, you know, well, where did you get these names? And I said, oh, the Austin phone book, and you know, I just picked out names that felt right to me, you know, and I realized that they felt right because they had certain significances, you know. And sometimes I'll change a name, you know, if I see something better, you know. But for me, it starts out as an intuitive thing rather than an intellectual kind of exercise. But then the meaning accretes around it for me. So the name Brunian was something that came up. It was just a name that I heard.
Huh.
And then I had to figure out why. So
no Brownian motion.
So well, then I figured that out.
Yeah.
You know, like I figured out. Well, you know, is he Brune? You know, like, or is he you know, Brownian? You know, is he you know, is he created or is he random? You know.
Yeah.
So it took on a lot of different meanings for me. You know, in a happy, lucky way, but. I mean, but I also really just viscerally wanted it to be like a name that sounds like a real name.
Well, I also mention this because you do have, and Vartan, by the way, Avatar, almost an anagram of that, and N, which would be a variable, I suppose. So the thing is you do have an explanation for why the kids are named the way that they are, which is what leads me to start thinking, oh, well, maybe he's got something up his sleeve. Maybe there's a purpose to every single thing here. But on the other hand, what's the balance between instinct and deliberation like this in names or even in some of the precise description that's throughout this book, something along those lines?
I am a very firm believer that to craft a good novel, you need meaning and mystery in equal proportions.
Yeah.
And I guess that goes back to the scientist and mystic thing a little bit. If you can just put your finger on something and say, oh, I understand all the reasons why, you know, he did that, and it just jumps out at me as being completely obvious, then the artifice is not successful. I mean, it just seems artificial. Whereas I look for things that are mysterious to me and that are suggestive of meaning.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up your Millions essay, where you wrote about your experience after The Savage Girl was published. You mentioned one incident in which a cigarette company wants to sponsor various events for the book, which is interesting in light of the fact that The Savage Girl contains a rather seedy rave sponsored by Camel. I'm curious, 10 years later, whether it's possible for fiction to rattle cages if everything is going to be co-opted by some marketing company, by some corporation. I mean, can fiction be dangerous? Is it this mystery that we're talking about that causes fiction to provoke? Or should we just let fiction, be organic, and if it gets co-opted, well, there's little the author can do about it. What of this?
The Savage Girl was very concerned with that subject.
Yeah.
When I was writing that, I was wondering, is it possible to write a satire anymore? You know,
yeah.
And with advertising companies owning, you know, having co-opted not only, you know, various books and songs and this and that, but the very form of satire. The ads seem to be satirizing themselves or satirizing other things, and it took away the meaning of social satire a little bit. So I was curious to see, you know, how I could thread those needles of irony and earnestness and try and make something that wasn't just completely snarky and meaningless,
yeah,
but that wasn't, you know, but that was earnest in a way still, but that was, I don't know, post-ironic, yeah, a little bit.
Something that is sincere without being ironic, sort of similar to what you described, like David Foster Wallace's E Unibus Plurum, something along those lines.
Well, I think that irony is very, very important still. So
yeah,
in a way, I was trying to rescue irony, I think. I think irony is something that allows us to synthesize opposites, you know? I mean, because if we don't have that, then we just have schizophrenia, you know? We just have this state in which we believe two different things and we just can't find any way to make them communicate.
Yeah.
So irony is this thing that allows us to see the, you know, to see the gray areas and to see and to see to see things with a little bit more precision and also lightness. But I don't think that ultimately that irony and sincerity are at odds with each other.
Yeah. But is irony enough of a tool with which to combat this system of co-opting?
No, I don't think it is anymore.
Yeah. Because they have parties on their side too.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Richard Powers' Plowing the Dark, which your book reminded me of.
Mm-hmm.
This book could almost be either a follow-up or a sequel because it deals with parallel narratives. It deals with a virtual reality situation. It deals with the idea of the military entertainment complex, which, you know, spoiler alert, sorry, but that is the ultimate resolution of Plowing the Dark. I saw that Mr. Powers was in fact in the acknowledgement section, and I'm curious how much of an influence Plowing the Dark was on this, and what do you do to shake off influences, or do you just simply embrace them?
Richard Powers is a colleague of mine at
yeah.
the University of Illinois, and so I've had the great privilege of getting to know him. He's a tremendously smart and generous guy, And his books are something that I always look forward to keenly to reading. There are a number of my contemporaries that I like very much, and that I feel like I take something from, that I learn something from. I personally, though, when I think about who my, you know, it's funny, I you know, maybe this is just me in denial, but I think about, when I think about influences, I think about George Eliot. I think of Middlemarch, how she was able to weave the microcosm and the macrocosm together into, you know, just our little individual lives and the broader cultural forces that shape society into, and really just define her age. And so that's a book that I look to a lot. I look to Dostoevsky for the raw emotional content and the maximalistic stuff.
That makes sense, because you're very good at humiliation. In that whole scene where Fred, late in the book, goes to Florida is just... I felt really it was a cringe situation right there. Yeah, which is exactly the kind of thing one would expect from Dostoevsky as well.
Well, thank you.
But I'm sorry, going back to your influence, it seems that it's more classically rooted? Or?
At least consciously, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly paying attention to certain of my contemporaries who I have a great respect for. And I don't know, I definitely read Plowing the Dark, and it occurred to me that I was approaching similar themes to stuff Richard Powers has done. I think it's a very different book, but you know, I can only, you know, feel like that's a compliment. So
yeah. Well, also, I wanted to ask you about the specific prose style in this, and by prose style, I'm not necessarily talking about the sentences. I'm talking more about how it's kind of a close third person, but it also has certain qualities of an unreliable first person narrator, because we're going along with Fred. He is stalking people, he's doing a few creepy things, and yet the tone is such that we're willing to actually go along for the ride and believe in him, even though he's not entirely being truthful. But then again, since it's in third person, it adopts some authenticity. And I'm curious just how you develop this very particular form of close third person, which is almost first person and almost in this unreliable mode.
That's a really interesting question. I haven't actually thought about it until this moment, but over the drafts, I went back and forth between third and first person.
Oh, okay.
And so maybe that's how that evolved. Yeah. It was in third person, I think, for most of its existence. And then in 2007, when there was a draft that I thought was done that turned out not to be done, and in a kind of traumatic way, and I needed to reimagine it, and brought George into it and all that. One of the ways that I reimagined it was by just changing it to first person, and I just needed to have a new angle on it.
Yeah.
So I had a feeling in the back of my mind that it wasn't right for the book ultimately, but it did allow me to get closer in to the character and to just sort of do away with some of the framework that's around a lot of third person narratives, you know, it allowed me to sort of take out some of the scaffolding so that once I finally did realize, oh yeah, no, I was kind of having dreams about it that took me, like, you know, where I would see holes that were eyes, like, getting chopped down. So once I did realize that it had to be back in the third person, and I think that some of that closeness managed to stay because of that.
So in order to pin Fred's out-of-body experience, so to speak, you actually had to have your own out-of-body experience as author god here, basically. Is it safe to say that when you went from first person to third person again, that certain things became clearer, such as like, oh, he had a twin brother. I mean, what happened to the structure when you went from back from first to third? Were there any serious like story detail changes, or what happened here?
Trying to remember.
There were some things
that I saw that were that had to be the way they were.
Yeah.
There were a lot of little changes that came very late that were actually very, very important to the book.
Yeah.
And the way that the book does it, you know, there still are trace elements of the first person in the book, and that's something that I figured out when I moved back to third person, and then I realized that, oh, wait a minute, no, the first person belongs here and it belongs here, and to me that was important and interesting in the way that it moves between perspectives and identities.
It seems to me also that you may have introduced the twin situation because you have this other subplot going on with Mira and Fred having thoughts about her, and yet simultaneously there's this very unusual there's this constant reference between the twins of like, oh, well, maybe they could share a woman, and then you have the very early part where they're basically masturbating each other, which is actually one of our first pieces of introduction to them, and then later on the corporate guy saying, well, why don't you two just kind of why did you guys never switch off? And if we are to believe your book, they never actually did that. On the other hand, the whole masturbation thing at the beginning really establishes that it's a narcissist situation. So, I'm curious how much of that was played up because you were trying to balance it with how Fred deals with Mira, and also the fact that while we're on the subject of Mira, I wanted to actually ask about how the T-shirt situation came about. She wears these T-shirts that are very hostile and can carry phrases, and then also the famous two photos of President Bush with the chimp and that kind of thing. Another twin imagery. How did the sexuality of the twins work in conjunction with the sort of unusual relationship that Fred has with Mira? How did you work that balance?
That's a really good question. There is a lot of interplay, you know, between Fred and George in terms of, you know, Fred has these dreams where he's sleeping with George's ex, and
that's,
you know,
right.
And I think that the way that relates to Mira particularly is that Mira has, well, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but in a way she has her own kind of twin situation, and for me, Fred and Mira are twins in a way.
You know,
they're twinned in terms of some of their circumstances and some of their searches that are going on in the book. I think that's how I would relate those things. The T-shirts, yeah, well.
I only say that because I'm wearing a T-shirt. Not something hostile, but, you know, being a T-shirt guy, I have to ask.
Yeah. No, I thought that would be a good way for her to be telegraphing, some of her views that she wouldn't come out and express. You know?
Yeah. I have to also ask why pretty much all of your adult characters live with their parents, which... you know, is not a particularly promising position for the next generation of innovators to be in. How did this come about? I'm curious.
Well, what do you mean? Who else lives with their parents?
You've got Mira, you've got Fred, got Sam sleeping at the office because he doesn't want to live with his parents, and he's got his apartment being rented out and that kind of thing. I mean,
maybe.
A lot of living with the parents, a lot of the boomerang generation, so to speak. Yeah.
It is true.
And they're in their 30s, too, in many cases.
Yeah. There is something about in a way the story has elements of a Bildungsroman, you know, like even though they're in their 30s I think that Fred and Mira's circumstances, you know, reflect each other in a way so that they informed each other in that way. But yeah, I don't know what that says about our generation.
Well, it's a perfect pre-recession situation to be in. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and I think this is also probably there in The Savage Girl as well, is do you think that much of the fiction that's been generated in the 21st century is very much about trying to find what's human within the seemingly inhuman? You have subjects here like technology and business acquisition and that sort of thing. I was alluding to this earlier in relation to my question concerning the post-ironic age, but I'm wondering if the solution or the, not the solution, but one potential remedy for a future direction of fiction may in fact be like, well, what is so fresh and human about something that we're going to look at in a very cold and indifferent manner? Is this of interest to you as a novelist? Or?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, technology is just such a part of our lives. You know, you read a lot of fiction that just doesn't want to go there.
Yeah.
You know, like it wants to stay 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It doesn't want to deal with even cell phones. Some of the you know plot lines you know that you'll find like don't even want to like deal with the fact that people have cell phones. So because that complicates the story. So I just feel like it's a part of our lives and it's informing our consciousness and how we think now. So I think it informs how we feel too, and also our utopian impulses. You know, just how we what all the things we hope for from technology. That we hope that it's going to be a utopia, and that we fear it's going to be a dystopia, and that in a way it's our karma. You know?
Yeah.
And so in a big way, and so it's just part of the world.
But I've had this discussion with friends about whether, if you settle upon a dystopia, whether that's a bit of a cop-out, because you're not really confronting the real. I mean, as bad as things are, there's always something good, or as good as things are, there's always something bad.
Yeah.
You have to, you can't be necessarily utopian or dystopian, you just have to face it. To what degree was this an issue when you were facing the very unknowable prospect of writing about the unknowable in Luminary?
Yes. To me, the Savage Girl plays with that kind of is this heaven or hell, and is this a dystopia or utopia, and I think Luminarium does the same thing. You know, I think it looks at our situation and looks at our urge for heaven and the ways that we project hell and heaven onto things and looks at what's really real, what does it even mean to get real?
I suppose it perhaps mirrors the question of faith. I mean, Holly, the mother in this, you have one moment at the end of the first part, I believe, where you describe her shifting from this very joyful position to this small figure who's sitting in front of a computer. And we see in that one moment how, oh, well, faith for her is a way of coping with the real and getting through the real. So it's almost just this question of, you know, I guess, to coin a word, an atopian view of the world. When you're writing about faith, you have to be atopian, so to speak.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
I like that word.
Yeah.
I think that gets at something that I was trying to get at, which was, if you take, you know, I was interested in finding out if you take all the supports away.
Yeah.
If you take all your illusions, all your narratives, all the stories you tell yourself to make yourself feel better or even worse, you know, what is that thing you're left with after that, you know, and is that thing related to faith, you know, and for me, I think it was in an interesting way. I mean, I started out thinking about faith and spirituality, I think the way that most people do, which is thinking that it means a set of beliefs,
Yeah.
But ultimately, there's an approach to spirituality that's not about belief. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that you know, in terms of if there's any hope for the future of faith and the future of spirituality, I think it goes more in the direction of demystifying rather than mystifying, looking at the illusions, looking at the narratives, and clearing them away.
But it's also interesting to me that faith in this book is pretty much constructive. I mean, you have to construct your own faith. In the case of Holly, I'm going to sort of amend my previous observation and say that Holly may be optimistic, but Sam, in specializing in how New York is going to be destroyed in Earth, and being so concerned almost in an over-the-top way of apocalyptic scenarios that he just loves programming, well, his faith is absolutely dystopic. So it's almost as if you're balancing out optimistic faith with pessimistic faith. Therefore, the question of what one's mood is sort of moot. Is this kind of what you were trying to do with the balance here? Or?
I think, you know, there's certainly a way that I read the book.
Yeah.
You know? But I also wanted to. I saw that the way the book was evolving, and it was a way that I wholly supported, was that I kind of wanted the book to function ultimately like that hole in the center, you know, of downtown.
Yeah.
As being this, you know, where everything else is around it. There are all these stories. There's all this spinning. There's all these narratives, and you get this little glimpse into this thing, and you know, what you're confronted with is your own way of constructing, you know, what you're bringing to it.
Yeah.
And so I think that there are different ways to read this book, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way it had to be for me. But for me, I do think, you know, that this thing that Fred and Mira were after, this faith without ignorance, is something that is possible and actually worth looking at.
But faith is also rooted in performance. The magic shows that we see with Vartan and Fred, the acting career.
Yeah.
That Vartan has, and also that we see with the films of Manfred.
Yeah.
It's almost as if, I guess, faith can occupy many roles, but it just has to be a creative act almost in this.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the question about imagination, you know, and imagination being a two-edged sword, you know.
Yeah.
There are these dynamic and constructive and affirming and deeply human aspects of imagination and creativity, and at the same time it is what leads to all our neuroses, all our dysfunction in society. There we have it.
Okay. Well, that seems a very good note to end. But Alex, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Ed, thanks very much.
Fantastic.